This lovely lady, oh my God, I've heard her speak so many times, and it's an incredible, incredible story. You guys are in for a huge treat. And it's really cool because my birthday and her birthday are all the same, and it's like, wow. So, Miss Tina, if you will come on up. That's where we try to get things going.
My name is Tina, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really happy to be here. I'm also an alumni. By the grace and power of God, through working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sobriety date of August the 22nd of 2000. And I'm going to tell you, for years, I had tried to get sober, and it just didn't work. And in 2000, I was so desperate. You know, I hoped that it worked, but I think at that time I was finally willing to go to any length. And I want to tell you that before getting here, there was no power greater than me, except for the law enforcement. But today I know that alcohol was my master. So alcohol was a power greater than me. And alcohol did, I don't have a whole lot of time tonight, but what we do is we share what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. We share in a general way. And I want to share briefly that before I found alcohol, what I was like from a very young age is just kind of dull. I had suffered from depression since I was very young. It was just kind of gray outside. And I had no hope. There was no life. I didn't have any aspirations. And I had a learning disability. I was a straight F student, in the seventh grade. That was it for me. School wasn't working. I just couldn't learn. I think I guessed on tests enough to make D's at some point. But I, was even in school. Nothing gave me excitement. And I operated from this place that I thought if I were loved just right, that I would be okay. My father died of an overdose when I was 3, and my mother was incapable of showing emotion in any form because she is one of us. And today I know that she is just absolutely broken because of alcoholism and the type of relationships that she's been in. But I really thought that if I were loved just right, that I would be okay. I'd feel content. And I remember dwelling in this place of pity, thinking, I heard that my dad loved me. I was 3 and I don't remember that, but I would go to this place and dwell in these negative emotions, hoping he was here, thinking, that I would be okay. And I'm going to tell you that that when I found alcohol, it took away all of those feelings. And before I found alcohol, what I know, I was full of fear. I was that kid that walked around with my head down, and I couldn't connect with any of you. I had no interest. But you put alcohol in me, and I have an interest in connecting with you. I remember going to the skating rink, and I would just kind of stood on the sideline. I was afraid to get out there. But this one particular night, you put alcohol in me, and I'm out there skating with you. There was a little more that happened. I remember going to that skating rink. There was this girl that reminded me of just like a pit bull, a bulldog or something, and she would pick on me. She scared the hell out of me, as a matter of fact. But this night that alcohol was in me, she came up to me, and she did the same thing that she always did. Well, there's one thing different is I reacted differently. I was no longer afraid, and she ended up on the ground. And I remember that moment. I felt powerful that night. I thought, there's nobody. I'm going to be able to stand up for myself, and I'm going to be able to do this life. That's what alcohol did. It made me feel like I'm going to be able to do this life. As I got older, I remember I wanted to go into the bars, and again, I wanted to connect with people, and I wanted to do the things that they were doing because it looked like they were having fun, but I was so paralyzed by fear, and I didn't feel like I was attractive enough. I didn't feel like I was good enough. I had all this negative stuff. You see, you put alcohol on me, and I start to feel a little courageous. You put a little more alcohol on me, and I'm able to get out there on that dance floor and dance with you. You put a little more alcohol on me, I have the courage to get on that table and dance for you. So my mind knew that alcohol did for me, made me somebody. It made me somebody. I was able to be something different than what I was. And that's all I know. Now, at an early age, at 15, I remember going into a blackout around alcohol. And I remember it took three officers to cuff me down and take me to the mental institution. But my mind doesn't remember that that I should quit drinking to have those effects. So I've been a blackout drinker since I was very young. And there hasn't been one morning that I woke up and they told me how generous I was and all the kind things that I did. You know, I would hear of all of the things that I did and the harm that I caused. And I would feel shame and remorse, and I would make promises to never do that again. And I meant it. But I would do it again. At 18 years old was my first arrest. I ran a red light. I hit a car. I could have killed a couple of people. And then I had my arrest for my first DWI. And that was in Harris County Jail. And I mean, that's a pretty big jail. And when you're standing down a hall with 50 to 100 other people and you're butt naked. See, my problem... See, I felt okay on alcohol, but you take it away from me, and I am not okay in my own skin. So all I experienced was a ton of humiliation, embarrassment, and I told myself, I am not coming here again. And I told myself, you know, in my mind, if only I manage better, that I'm not going to experience those consequences anymore. See, it never occurs to me that I should quit drinking and driving. I just need to manage better. But the problem is once I pick up, you know, I can't tell you what time I'm going to be back. I can't tell you. I may plan on going out and drinking for a few hours, and I may not be arriving until the sun is coming up the next morning. I have, you know, not only can I not tell you what's going to happen, but I don't even know the effects that I impose on other people during that time. So I get out of jail at 18 years old, and I really believed that I would never experience that again. I was not getting arrested again. I want to tell you that when I got here in 2000, I've probably been arrested 30 times, and I was facing 10 to 99 or 25 to 99 years in prison because I'm a habitual felon. And fear of those consequences and the desire to not go there again was never enough to keep me from not picking up that first one. You know, I started working in sales, door-to-door sales at a young age, 18 or 19. And that first day, I knocked on those doors and I tried to sell those newspaper subscriptions and I couldn't sell anything. But that next day, I knocked on a door and somebody offered me a beer and I graciously accepted. That night, I became top salesperson. Yep. That week, I became top salesperson of the week. I became top salesperson of the month. I became top salesperson of the year. I started winning trips to Colorado, bonuses. I mean, alcohol? See, I couldn't see. Alcohol did so much for me. It didn't matter what it was doing to me, the alcoholism and then the effect it had on other people. I could only remember what it was doing for me. But eventually it stopped. Eventually it quit working. So prior to that, at 19 years old, I remember being out drinking, and I was introduced to some other stuff that allowed me to stay up longer, and I could drink more, and I didn't seem to go into those blackouts. And I liked it. And pretty quick, I realized that it cost some money to do that stuff. And so I had a grand idea. You know, I'm such a great salesperson. I was going to get my product for free. And within 6 months, I had my first two delivery charges. And I am locked up facing 10 to 99 on two cases, 10 to 99 years in prison. And the only thing I can think about is I can't be separated from those kids. Oh, by the way, I had kids in between this time. I had just turned 16 years old when my son Dylan was born. And at the age of 17, my daughter Cassidy was born. And this is a very special night because my I mean, this is the first time my daughter has been willing to show up in a room, anything close to Alcoholics Anonymous, to hear the stories, you know, and what's been happening. So I'm, you know, these are tears of joy. It's also a very, it's the first time that my son and I have been able to share our recovery within the same time frame. So this is a very special night for me. Well, at 19 years old, the only thing I can think about when they're telling me I'm going away for 10 to 99 years are those babies. Because, see, when I gave birth to each of them, and I thought that, you know, when I got pregnant at a very young age, I thought, when this baby is born, this baby's going to love me unconditionally, and I'm going to be okay. See, I thought if I were loved just right, I'd be okay. And he was born, and I fell in love with that baby. It was absolutely beautiful. And I told him that I was going to take care of him, nurture him, and give him everything that my mother couldn't give me. And I meant it. 14 months later, my daughter was born. Then I fell in love with her. And I told her the same thing, and I meant it. And the book tells me that I have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but I can't live up to it, even though I would have liked to, you know, even though I would like to. You know, she was 3 months old, and I was hitting the bars. So, see, I had these emotions and desires, but my actions looked like I only care about me. Because, see, once you put the drink in me, I don't know when I'm going to show back up. And my disease was progressive. And basically, I gave up everything. I gave up the relationship that I had with my children. I gave up anything important to me to get what I needed to feed my disease. And I've been there was a time I was locked up for almost 2 years in TDC, and I remember coming out of there. All the times before this point, I thought if I only managed just well, if I manage it better, it's going to be okay. But this time I was done for good and for all. And this is when I came to Austin in 1994. And I had no reservations, and I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. And I went to meetings. I got a sponsor, and I worked some steps. A year later, I found out that I had cancer, and I had to have a surgery. And it was a 15-hour surgery, and they put me on some pain medication. And I told myself I'm not going to allow myself to become addicted, and I'm not going to abuse them. Well, I want to tell you, I wasn't clear on my first step. See, if I'm saying I'm not going to allow that to happen, then I think I have some sort of control. And what happened is I didn't abuse them, but they treated my alcoholism. See, without it, you know, I became so restless, irritable, and discontented. And you give me that. And it was only one pill a day for 6 months until alcohol was put in front of me. But it treated my alcoholism. See, I was restless, irritable, and discontented. And I put that pill in me, and I get a sense of ease and comfort. I'm not a pill addict. But it was treating my alcoholism. And, you know, what I wasn't clear on, that I had really lost the power to choose whether I drink or not. And I had crossed that invisible line at around the age of 21 to where my alcoholic mind chose for me. And that's what I got clear on when I got here. And I want to tell you that when I got here, it wasn't that I was really, I didn't believe this deal would work for me. But I had been arrested 2 times in a 6-month period. And I mean, I was I had been on probation or parole since I was 18 years old. And at 34, I could never get off any of those. See, I didn't have any problem with getting separated from alcohol because they separated me from it. The problem was staying separated from it. That's a problem that I had. You know, I drank just fine. I like the way, as a matter of fact, I like to drink and drive. I like the way it feels. You know, everybody else had a problem with it, including the law enforcement. So my problem was me, you know, and without it, I don't have a solution to life. And I want to go back there because, see, I carried so much shame for a long time that these children that are so important to me, I was in the middle of my alcoholism and using the other stuff that I was using. And my son was living in his own fear-driven self, whatever. And he decided to hop a train. And he hopped that train, and they made it to Taylor, Texas, and he fell off and fell under that train. And I got a phone call, and they told me that my son had fallen under the train, and I'm going to tell you, I didn't have it within me to hear the information. You know, is he dead? Is he alive? What happened? And they told me that he had survived the accident, that he was alive, but they told me he had amputated his arm, and he was pretty beat up. I thought about him for a split second, but then I thought about me. How am I going to handle this? See, I didn't have the skills to handle. I didn't have the strength. I didn't have the power to handle life on life's terms. So what do? I keep on drinking more because, see, I can't deal with it. And I do show up in the hospital, you know, to see him, and I can't even hug him because I feel so toxic. I can't show up to be the mother that I really want to be. And I had so much shame around that. And see, and I'm drinking and I'm doing what I do, and I'm doing it in the bathroom of his room. Because, see, I can't stop. If I had the power to choose, I would have stopped. And I run out. And what my alcoholism, it looks like, is when I run out, I have to get some more. And I leave, and I plan on being back in 45 minutes. And 3 days pass. So when I got here in 2000, I could not live with me. See, I thought I was choosing that. And each and every time I pick up again, you know, it's like, why are you there? My kids thought I was choosing that over them. And yeah, it looked like that. But see, I suffer from a disease, and I have lost the power to choose. And I come in here, and I don't know what's going to happen. You know, I'm facing 10 to 99 and 25 to 99 years in prison, and I did not want to deal with that. And I go into detox, and they give me some medication. I don't know what they give you in there, but they made me sleep. And I didn't want to wake up. I wanted to stay on those. I did not want to wake up and come to. I wanted my life to be a bad dream. I just wanted it to go away. And then for the last year before getting sober, I tried to take my life. I was ingesting as much of that stuff as I could, and drinking as much and taking everything. And many of times would go into a blackout while I was driving and not know how I got from point A to point B, but I was still alive. I was like, damn it. And I come in here not really wanting to live. I was just scared to death. I was scared they were going to bust me for a dirty UA. And I come in for the wrong reason. And then I get out of detox, and I have to go engage with those women and do the things that they want you to do. And I was not feeling any of it. But some people started carrying a message to me. And, you know, I remember it started in treatment right here. And I don't care. You know, I didn't believe in a guy. And I remember hearing someone say, I don't care what you believe in. Get on your knees and pray. And I did. It was uncomfortable. But I did. And I had what they call a first step experience while I was in here. I just couldn't understand how I got here again. Have you guys ever been at that place? It's like, how did I get here again? When I meant it, that I was done for good and for all. How did I get here? And I was asking whatever it was. And I got it really clear. That I am the problem, and that I suffer from everything on page 52. I suffer from this depression, and I suffer from, I'm full of fear. And, you know, this is the way it shows up, and without a true solution to me, I will drink again. I need a sufficient substitute. You know, then I come to learn that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. So I had an awakening when I was in here. I had a first step experience, and in the doctor's opinion, it says, unless a person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. And I had that psychic change while I was in here, and I'm so grateful. But see, that psychic change alone is not going to keep me sober. I was willing to go to any lengths, and I remember getting involved with the group, and I was scared of them. As a matter of fact, I was, you know, our ego shows up in so many different ways. Either we're better than or less than, and mine showed up as not good enough. And I was so afraid of those women. You know, I just thought they weren't going to accept me. I thought I was something, you know, I thought I was unique. And I thought they were going to judge me. Later I found out that they were, and they still are. But, you know, I was willing to go to any lengths. And they wanted me to show up and make coffee, and I did. And they wanted me to contribute whatever it was. It's like I didn't say no. You know, I heard them say, if you do what we do, you can have what we have. And see, after I had that first step experience, I had some hope. It's like, I know all those other times didn't work, but I had some hope that it was going to be different this time because I got the second part of step one, that I am powerless over that drink when it's not in my body. And I am willing to go in any lengths. And at a few months sober, they wanted me to come back here and take a meeting to the women, you know, give up 2 hours of my time. I wasn't interested. But I did it. The magic happened then. I walked out of here, and it didn't matter if I had a job. It didn't matter if I had a home. It didn't matter if I had a car. I felt the presence of that power. And I knew from that point on that I have a purpose. At 3 months sober, that I had a purpose and that God was going to use me in ways that I couldn't even imagine. And I started hearing a God, and a God told me, Tina, you're not what you think you are, and you're not what others think you are. You are a perfect child of God, just broken. And I'm going to put you back together. I also heard within that same meditation that if you focus on what the real problem is and change your actions, that you will never spend another day in jail. My attorney couldn't tell me that. My attorney told me people like you don't change. And man, yeah, at 10 months sober, he saw something happening in my life. He goes, Tina, the DAs, man. See, the DAs didn't look at me as an alcoholic. They looked at me as a drug dealer. That's because I was one. But DAs were not giving in at all. You know, I'd been on probation or parole, and I had used up all of my chances. And I'm facing habitual felony charges as a minimum of 25 years. I'm going to tell you that I had tapped into a faith. And I got that fear is my problem. So, and I just held on to that divine inspiration. And I heard that if you focus on what the real solution is, that you will never spend another day in jail. And at 11 and a half months, I had to face that judge. I didn't have a family member there. See, I had destroyed all of my relationships. They didn't have any hope for me. But I had the people in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and another fellowship that had written letters on my behalf, and they were there to support me. And Judge Lynch took time to read those letters. He overwrote the DAs and said, something's happening in this woman's life, and I'm not sending her to jail. I'm going to tell you, I tapped into a power greater than the law enforcement, which has saved my life. And I hadn't spent another day in jail, and I was granted 2 10-year probation. I didn't live in those 10 years, not one time, of fear of getting in trouble. I just lived in the solution of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I discharged both of those. And by the way, it was one of them was habitual, one screw-up, and it was a minimum of 25 years. And they just don't give those type of probations out. And in 2011, I discharged those probations, and I'm a free woman for the last 2 years for the first time in my entire adult life, and I'm 47 years old. So I am so grateful. And but it's only because of the people in these rooms and the people that have come before us and that aren't even alive today that put this in action for people like us to live. And I don't have a whole lot of time, but my life has changed. So alcoholism destroys relationships. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship restores relationships. And I have a relationship with my children, and I'm able to be a mother. And more than that, I'm able to be a grandmother. And the level of selfishness and self-centeredness that I suffer from, when I found out that when my daughter was pregnant a couple of years ago, I wasn't happy. All I could think about was me, that she's not going to be able to take care of this baby, and I'm going to have to take care of it. And through the power of this program and God healing me, I need. And she, one day she said one thing to me, and she doesn't even know. She said, Mom, aren't you excited? And I wasn't. And I had to sit and look at myself, and I started praying to God, asking God to change me. And I started looking at it differently, and I was able to show up and watch that baby be born. And see, if I would have been making decisions based on me, I would be missing out on the joy of that beautiful baby that has opened up a whole new channel of love in me. And my son, I got to watch him going down the same path, man. And he would be in prison before. And I remember one time he said, Mom, will you send me a big book? And as a recovered mother, your kid asks you to send you a big book. I run it. I'm so excited to do that because I thought he was interested in this way of life. And he tried it for a little while, and it wasn't for him. And I just sat back and watched him. And I watched him progressively go back the other direction and experience the same kind of consequences that I was experiencing. And I kept trying to impose my solution on him, saying, Dylan, man, if you come this way, you do what I did, you can have what I have. And he said, I don't want what you guys have. I'm not one of you. And I had to, and this is real quick because it's so important to me that, one day, he had, and I don't want to tell his story, but, he had the idea, like a lot of guys have an idea, that they want to grow marijuana legally over in California. And I, you know, if that's what he wants to do, that's okay. But one day when he called me because he was so afraid of well, I don't know what it was, but he told me he was going to go on, he was going to burn his fingerprints and take off and go live that life. And the way that I felt about that, first of all, I saw that as completely insane. But all I thought about was my baby, you know, my what's going to happen to him. And in that conversation, he said something. And it's funny how they'll say something and I get to stop and really look at me. And he said, I don't think I can trust anybody anymore. I don't even know if I can trust you, Mom. Because he wasn't really safe in how he was living at that time. And it made me step back and realize that my job as a mother is not to try to impose my solution on him, to allow him his journey. And if he wants to burn his fingerprints and go grow marijuana, that's his journey and it's okay. And my job as a mother is to love him and let him know that he can trust me. So if at any time he needs to pick up that phone and call me, he'll know that he can. And I backed up. But I did start doing something else that he wasn't aware of. And I started incorporating this prayer in a way that I have learned through a book that I study. This positive prayer and his love for God, his love for the program, and his love for helping other people. And he called me a couple months later and says, Mom, I'm willing to do anything to save my butt. And I picked him up and I took him to a treatment center. And all the way there, he told me he was going to go in there and teach them something about God. And I just had to keep my mouth shut. Anyway, my life is amazing. I have a life that I really don't deserve based on my actions prior to getting here. And this is one place, that my most favorite place to come and carry the message to. I don't know why, but I love being here. And it is such an honor to be able to share this podium with my son, Dylan. So now I'm going to pass it to Dylan.
Hey, guys, I'm Dylan. I'm a recovered alcoholic addict. Normally, I think about what I'm going to say, but since the when somebody else is speaking, but since she was speaking about me, I couldn't think about much. Semi-nervous. So thank you, Mom, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. You know, I guess I'll briefly go over my childhood. I remember growing up. I guess the furthest of my memories is probably about 4 years old. I remember my mother and father fighting. You know, I think that's one of my furthest memories. At around that same time, I remember my dad being mad at me and throwing a bowl of my spaghetti on the ground. I didn't like that. You know, and I just remember, my dad, he wished he was a rock star, right? So he attempted to be a singer, you know, but he had alcoholism very badly and never was successful. Matter of fact, he was always the laugh of the crew. He was always the one passing out and falling at their parties where they were throwing their parties and had their band set up and stuff. So you know, and I remember, you know, my mom, she drank, she runs and guns, you know, and I remember staying at home a lot, basically with my sister, you know, and I was always told, do as I say, not as I do. You know, and I just remember couldn't wait to do what I wanted to do, what I was attracted to, right? What I was attracted to is what I saw my parents doing. It's what I wanted to do, and I just couldn't wait. And as soon as I got the opportunity to start doing what I wanted to do, I started doing that very well. And you know, I guess my addiction to drugs and alcohol is probably pretty similar to a lot of y'all's. Is you know, I did what I want. I wanted to manage my life, right? I wanted to manage my feelings. See, At the time, I didn't understand what my problem was. You know, but now that I'm over here, I get to see what my problem was is I was the manager of everything. See, and I did not know how to accept life. And I was not willing to accept life. Either things were going to go my way or they weren't going to go anymore. I'd ruin them. You know, I'd make them to where they don't go for you, too. Right? Because I'd be upset. And I considered myself a smart alcoholic addict. You know, I figured out that, you know, I could drink sometimes and, you know, I can switch up. You know, if my addiction was speed, you know, I'd get some Xanax to come down. You know what I mean? You know, after a while, I figured out that speed was not good for me. It really deteriorated my body. So I'll just do LSD and mushrooms and smoke weed, right? I consider myself pretty smart because, and I'm grateful that I did have the knowledge that I had because I would alter what I did where I didn't stay in any same sort of addiction that really drove my body down too much. But where I got drove down was very similar to my mom's story, which you don't hear this very often. So it's kind of weird that we both have the same story. It's weird as shit. So, I'm not supposed to cuss here. I was, you know, I've been to prison twice due to drug dealing and getting caught with drugs. And I had 2 DWIs. And, you know, eventually it all caught up to me. And I was facing 25 to 99 years in jail. I was a habitual criminal. Same thing, you know. And the same exact story, you know, that my lawyer, I said, you know, I told him, I said, well, what if I go to a rehab? You think that'll help? He said, no, we can get the habitual waived. We could probably get you 7 to 10 years in TDC. He said, but just try to plan on going and doing some time. And I didn't want to go back. I've been twice. I know I don't like it there, right? I got friends in California. They got wheat fields and stuff. You know, I could go get put in a wheat field and hide under the radar. And that was my plan. I was dead serious about it. I was studying spirituality at the time, watching The Secrets. I had my vision board, right? My vision board was to go to California, then to Colorado, and, you know, I was going to have these homes, and I don't know how I was going to accomplish all this stuff, but I was just going to do it with my vision, right? Positive thinking. But what I realized was, you know, through this thing I did, I called my mom, and I told her, I said, look, I said, I love you. I said, I would like for you to stay a part of my life, but I'm taking off. I'm burning my fingertips. I'm not going in front of that judge. I'm not going to allow another man to judge me. I didn't do anything wrong. I was drinking and driving. That's not bad. I didn't hurt anybody. So, I was justified. And I wasn't going to let another man judge me. And I said, I love you, and I would like to stay in contact with you. But I have to trust you that you're not going to turn me in. And I know it was the hardest thing for her to hear. I know that. You know, and I want to rewind a little bit to, you know, she got in recovery when I was 18, I believe, 17 or 18, 19, somewhere around there. And I remember her, you know, coming and telling me about it. I remember, like, every single time that I get arrested, you know, and whether it's, hey, mom, bond me out, or hey, mom, come get my money off my books to bond me out, she was like, I'll do it if you're willing to go to rehab. What's a smart drug addict say? I'll go to rehab. You know, and I tell you, for the longest time, I felt like, you know, it was being pressured on me, right? And I want to throw this out there because, you know, I realize what this type of story is for it. You know, there's a lot of parents out there that are getting sober, that that their children are still out there doing their thing, and it's extremely hard to watch. You know, I know this because I get sober and I got friends. You know, I have other family members, right? And it's hard for me to watch them. And I just want to drill this shit into them, right? I want to slap recovery into people. You know, it's just something that happens to me. I have a spiritual experience. I get a relationship with God, and I want everybody to have it, right? But the thing that I watched my mom go through and being on the other side, the way that I ended up getting my help was, you know, at some point before, I think she spent a lot of her time in recovery trying to pressure it on me. Matter of fact, I think she spent more time doing that than she did not doing it. It was a very short time that she finally just accepted me for who I was. You know, she finally just realized, you know, that there is no convincing me that I needed, right? And that it was my experience that needed to convince me. And it was through that, her accepting me for who I was, that she got me on her team, right, is what happened. And, you know, when it came down to that positive thinking thing with the vision board and stuff that I had all ready to go, the only problem with that positive thinking thing is I have a very powerful mind, and I could think positively all day long, but I don't have the power to not think negatively when it comes. See? And I had this belief system that if I just thought positively through this whole thing, that it would work and I would be fine and I would get away. Well, negative thinking started coming in me. The dark night of the soul, as I hear a guy talk about, it hit me. And I realized, oh crap, I'm screwed. Now, I've already started thinking negative. I messed up already. And I didn't know what to do. And I remember breaking down in my garage and just crying, you know. And I thought I knew God, man. I thought I knew a lot about God, but I broke down and cried, and I said, man, why me, right? Why me? I said, whatever you want me to do. And prior to this, my mom had mentioned something about her maybe able to help me get into a really good rehab. And I am alumni from here as well. I didn't stay sober out of here. I've been here 3 times, though. I never stayed very long. So, you know, after that thought and that experience that I had, I reached out to her and I said, well, where is this rehab? What is it about? I told my lawyer, hey, man, what do you think if I go to a rehab? He says, you're just going to waste your time and money. He says, just get prepared to do time. But something told me, go to this rehab. I didn't want to stay sober. And that's why I want to get this out there too, because this ain't about if you want to get sober, right? It wasn't about if I wanted to get sober. So I didn't want to get sober. I just wanted to get the heat off of my butt. And I took this chance. I had a little bit of money saved up of my own that I was going to be traveling with. And this rehab was really expensive. I didn't have nowhere near the money. But they granted me the rest. They let me pay them the little bit I had and granted me the rest to go to this place. And when I got there, you know, I've been in and out of the rooms. I've attempted sobriety before. I've stayed around for a few months. I've got a sponsor, and I've done all 11 steps before. No, I even attempted the 12th step before. I never had a first step, though. Right? So I've done the steps before, and I didn't stay sober. This time, and I never really related either. See, with my prior recovery, I'd hear my mom share, and I'd just say what she said. I sounded good in the rooms. Real good. This time, I related to the book. They started talking about selfish and self-centeredness, right? In the doctor's opinion, they break down that cycle of I pick up, mental obsession kicks in, I'm off on my sprees, I come back with firm resolution to never do it again, and then I'm back, and I'm back, and I'm back. And it's that vicious cycle, right? So I can relate to that. I can relate to the selfish and self-centeredness being the core. You know, I was able to look at my whole entire life and say, wow, every single decision I have made has been to benefit myself, right? With every relationship I've had, family, friends, girlfriends, everything. It was all to benefit me 100%. I didn't know how to take somebody else's life into consideration. It never occurred to me. And that stuck right here with me. And that was when I had my first step experience. They took us through the work slow, but around that time was when I had my first step experience, was when I realized that I am selfish and self-centered, and I am hopeless to accomplish living life if I continue trying to live the way I've been living, right? And if I keep trying to manage the show, it's never going to work. Because I can relate to trying to manage and it not working, and tweaking it to manage it again and it not working, and tweaking it a little more to manage it again and not working. I have a whole lot of experience with that, right? I don't have a whole lot of experience with successfully living life, though. And something happened to me, man, and I can tell you I did not want to quit. I told my mom right the day before I went, I smoked a joint in her backyard and said, I'm just going to learn how to smoke marijuana sometimes. I'm not going to stop altogether. So I've been sober a little over 2 years today, and I like being sober today. You know, I don't... struggle with the mental obsession on picking up. I'm around alcohol sometimes. I've been around pot. I've been in some sordid places, and it doesn't bother me. You know, I have experience with a new life that I would not trade for what I had, right? No way. And I think that's what this whole thing is about, at least for me, you know. So when I in the rehab I was in, they had me start doing my 10 and 11 step before I got through any of the other steps, you know. So prayer and meditation in the morning, nightly at night, and 10 stepping, right? when things crop up, praying for them to be removed, sharing them with somebody. We started practicing those before I got through my steps. You know, when I got through my steps and I got out, I think for the first year or something, I was real on top of that stuff. You know, prayer and meditation in the morning, nightlies at night. And I want to tell you, because I hear a lot in the rooms, I hear people with sometimes sufficient amount of time struggle with, you know, if they didn't get their nightly done, they feel bad, you know, or... they didn't pray and meditate, their days messed up. You know, and I'm here to tell you, I've had a lot of practice with doing both, doing it and not doing it. And whether I do my nightly or not, or whether I meditate in the morning or not, doesn't affect the way the rest of my day goes, right? But what has happened to me through this journey is I have formed a relationship with a power that is greater than my mind. Is what I have done. And I can't explain this power. For me, it's my heart. And that's basically what my God is. Because see, my heart is pushing me. My heart is constantly pushing me. And my brain is trying to stop my heart from pushing me. This is just how I see things. You know, and the way that I handle myself is what, in all situations throughout my day, is what affects my spirit, right? And the book says something about these thoughts must go with us constantly, right? I need, and in my life, I am, and I'm not bragging because I'm just that sick, constantly praying. All through the day, I'm constantly praying. I'm seeing new stage characters that are cropping up. You know, we'll talk about this work a little bit. You know, my the inventory. You know, on the fourth step, I really got to see a lot of truth. Uh-huh. Oh, it is. Oh, wow. So, I don't have a lot of time. I want to talk about the inventory, man. It's very important. And to me, that is the most important part of my recovery, is inventory. When I first did my inventory, I had no clue what it was going to do. I did it to the best of my ability. What I did was I saw a whole lot of truth about myself. And what I continue to do on a daily basis and on a minute-by-minute basis is observe myself, you know, because this part of me is constantly trying to show up, right? This part of me is constantly trying to resist. This part of me does not want to accept, right? When I want to do something, I want to do it still. I don't like not doing it. I don't like not being able to do it. But what I've learned is staying on top of myself in constant inventory, and man, now I actually am very grateful when I want to do something and it doesn't go my way. I've actually gotten really grateful about that, because there's power behind that every single time, right? And this is what living life is about, because life is never going to get perfect, right? Life is always going to be a struggle. I want to tell you, my mom, I just want to, before I stop, you know, my mom, watching her on this journey, you know, has been the biggest part of my recovery, because, you know, it took a long time. They talk about that amends process, how, you know, when I get sober, I all of a sudden think everybody needs to love me and, you know, listen to what I say because I'm doing good now and stuff. But, you know, I was on the other side of that with her, man. She got sober and stayed sober a long time. And you know what? I still wasn't trying to hear anything she had to say. You know, it took a long time for me to really see it. But she stuck around. She kept doing what she was doing. And eventually it wore off on me, right? And eventually it dawned on me, my mom knows what she's doing, right? My mom has found a neat way of life. And I have watched her transform so much, you know, that was such a gift, you know, and being able to get on this side of life with her and start doing the same things. I'm now getting to watch my life transform, you know, and I'm learning how to show up in relationships and to take others into consideration. And it's not all about me. And life is awesome when it's not all about me. Life sucks when it's all about me. Man, when the pressure is on me on whether all of y'all are going to be okay or not, that's a lot of pressure. And you know, when it's not on me, man, and when it's not about me, it's so much better. Acceptance, they say, is the trick, and it absolutely is. You know, the first thing I had to accept was I'm not going to be able to get drunk and get high anymore, right? Once I accepted that, though, I moved on, right? And that's what that first step is about. Realizing that I'm powerless over the whether or not I'm going to pick up or not. And I'm hopeless if I continue going and I can't manage my life. I accept that and I move on. Anyway, I'm grateful to be here. And thank you guys for letting us.